You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, September 8th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow. The New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Elliot Spitzer talking about jobs, banks, jobs and banks. Banks and banks of jobs. Also, a rundown of the last night's clown car convention. Literally, like these people living in an alternative universe. It was like watching a play. It was sort of like watching a play, like a sort of like a strange play. Low lights coming up later in the program tonight. President Obama's second bite at the stimulus apple. What will he offer? Will it make a difference? Particularly because tomorrow he'll come out with a call for cuts. The super committee meeting today for the first time as we speak. Post office in jeopardy. All that and more on today's program. But first, some brief house cleaning. Yesterday at the end of the program, I put it to you folks whether or not I should go to the Take Back American Dream conference. Said if you wanted me to go, contribute something, put a nickel on the end of that contribution so I know that it's for the conference. And if we don't have enough money, I would refund that to you. Well, I cannot thank you enough. It took merely hours following the show, and we got plenty to go down there and to stock up the trip reserve and to even upgrade the equipment a little bit for, I mean, a huge upgrade. We'll have it now, a mobile satellite truck, which will which will allow us to broadcast. Not quite.
So we're putting the computers in a shopping cart.
Right. We're gonna dump everything. We're just gonna all put it in a mobile satellite truck and head down to Washington D.C. So I will be broadcasting live on October 5th from the Take Back American Dream conference and providing some audio from the panels, and hopefully I'll get a couple of good guests there and give you a sense of what sort of the the conference, I think, is going to be different this year. Generally, it's been more sort of insidery, but this Take Back American Dream organization run by Van Jones is a little bit more outsidery. So I'll be able to report from there and give you an update. But first, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Elliot Spitzer. And stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
We are back at Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to this program former governor, former attorney general of New York State, Elliot Spitzer. Elliot, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Great to be chatting with you.
Tonight, President Obama is going to basically take a second bite, I guess, at the stimulus apple. And we've seen some reports that he's going to offer at least a top-line package of $300 billion. And, you know, over the past couple of weeks, you've been writing at Slate magazine, Slate Online magazine, a
right.
couple of ideas for the president to go forward. And one of them is that he should really focus on helping the American homeowner. And,
correct.
And by doing so, require banks, I think you basically propose a principal cram down using the leverage we have of the banks. Now, it seems to me that almost from the beginning of his administration, there has been a I don't want to get go too far here, but pathological
right.
a hesitancy to take on the banks.
You're not going too far. There has been perhaps, you know, Sam, let me put it this way. One of the most fundamental questions that's being asked and has been asked over the last 4 years, so it goes back before President Obama was in office to the end of the Bush administration, but from the moment that the economic cataclysm began to erupt, the question has been, who's going to pay for all the excess leverage in the system? And the answer that has been given over and over again has been taxpayers and the middle class have been paying, and the banks have not been paying. Now, you can maybe debate both sides of the issue. Obviously, I don't want to talk for you, but certainly my feeling has been the banks should have put in an awful lot more. We've used tax dollars to bail them out, give them the bonuses again, and permit them to revert to normal, cleaning up their balance sheets. We have left homeowners with this enormous exposure, and we've left the economy in a state of distress. Many of us were saying back at the beginning, if all you deal with is the bank's balance sheets, you're not dealing with the disease, you're only dealing with the symptom. And the banks created this mess, in my view. Make them contribute to the solution. The solution really has got to be, in the housing sector, reforming a lot of these mortgages. And you're right, the Obama administration has not done anything that takes any real bite out of what the banks have got to do.
And what accounts for this? I mean, he, from the very beginning of his administration, he surrounded himself with Reubenites, I guess it's fair to say.
Yep.
And he continues. I mean, is there anybody left in the administration? I mean, Geithner, I think it's been reported, when it came time for the stimulus, he said, you know, too much stimulus is like sugar for the economy. It's a sugar high. It's not healthy. And tonight, President Obama is reported to offer this $300 billion package, half of which is going to come from payroll tax moratorium,
right.
which is a fairly ineffective form of
stimulus. It's more of the same. It's more of the same. I've never quite understood the metaphor, but I don't know if it's new wine in old bottles or old wine in new bottles. I don't know, but one or the other. I mean, it's unfortunately more of the same, and it hasn't worked as well as we might have wanted. Look, I'm one of those who believes that the stimulus did work a little bit.
Right.
Things would have been worse had we not done it. Now, that's not a terribly, you know, that's not exactly the chant you want going at your political rally. It could have been worse if we hadn't done it, doesn't win elections. It is economically the case. I don't think that extending the payroll tax alone is going to be enough. That's why I do think he's got to do something big and fundamental in the housing market. And I haven't heard, at least in the sort of things that are creeping out of the White House, that that's part of what they're talking about. And you're exactly right. He's been surrounded by the people, you know, Tim Geithner and now Bill Daley. And I don't want to speak ill of them as individuals. I'm sure they're good, decent people. I know Tim Geithner, you know, from dealing with them over the years. I just disagree with them. And I think Tim has been reported, and I believe it to be the case, that he didn't want to restructure the banking system at all. He thought this was just kind of one of those things that happens. There's nothing structurally wrong. I believe there is and was and continues to be a structural problem. We have accelerated growth and concentration of banking power, not decelerated that, and we are not still moving capital to those sectors where we need it, and we're still not dealing with the excess leverage and debt in the housing market, and that's what's depressing the housing market and has contributed to such a downward pressure on so much of our economy. One of many causes, but that's a big one.
And it seems to me that not only has there been a reluctance to, or even maybe that's even too soft of a word, to restructure the banks, but there also seems to be a fundamental determination to stop any accountability. I mean, there was a story yesterday, I think it was in, or I saw it yesterday anyways, an American Banker, that there's clear indication that banks have been involved in fraud insofar as they were getting kickbacks from mortgage insurance, that they were encouraging more mortgage insurance than necessary, that that HUD delivered a huge glossy-bound book to the DOJ 2 years ago, and they have done nothing on this investigation. We see the administration reportedly a couple of weeks ago pressuring Eric Schneiderman, New York Attorney General, to sign on to a basically immunity for the banks in terms of the securitization. Give me your sense of what's going on there.
Well, to say I'm disappointed in the Justice Department's efforts in this domain is obviously an understatement. I don't want to start weaving conspiracy theories and say they're in the tank and this and that, although, at moments it's obviously tempting to sort of say things like that. But at a minimum, I'm just enormously disappointed that there has not been sufficient credibility and accountability. And as you point out, saying to those who do want to push forward with meaningful investigations, Eric Schneiderman in particular, that he shouldn't do so, I think is fundamentally wrong. And I think Eric is doing what is correct in saying, listen, the banks want to get sort of broad waivers. They'll pay some money, but they want broad waivers for their wrongdoing in the entirety of this mess. At least let's know what happened and investigate before we grant them that waiver. And once again, the White House is saying, no, just let them pay some money and give them a blank check. It's the wrong way to proceed, and it speaks to the American public about a system that hasn't changed. And if we were hoping for transformational politics, it doesn't speak to that. And look, I said when the first cabinet was appointed, the first cabinet looked very much like continuity you can believe in rather than change you can believe in.
Right. And, and I don't think it's – I mean, at the very least, putting aside the notion of conspiracy theories, at the very least, there seems to be a fundamental favoring of, we have Catherine Wild coming out, who is a member of the Federal Reserve of New York, sits on the board of the Federal Reserve of New York, who's saying that Main Street is Wall Street, or rather that Wall Street is Main Street. I mean, putting aside the notion of why the Department of Justice is not going after these multiple fronts of investigations, putting aside the fact that the administration, through Sean Donovan at HUD, is also pressuring Eric Schneiderman, you could argue that the Department of Justice has some independence. I don't think HUD has that level of independence from the administration.
Well, let's come back to Kathy Wild for a moment. I know Kathy, very pleasant, nice person to get along with, her great. But I think, as you point out, this confusion or the ability to say Wall Street and Main Street are the same is sort of the Alice in Wonderland world we've been living in. And I think, look, she speaks for the New York City Partnership. The New York City Partnership doesn't make any bones about the fact that it is really a voice for the investment banks and the major financial institutions in the city. That's fine. But that is by no stretch of the imagination can you confuse that as being a Main Street voice. And I think when you look at the job numbers, when you look at what has been going on across our economy, you realize that what has been tried the past couple of years by this administration in terms of resuscitating our financial system has not worked for the vast majority of the economy.
And I know you just have a limited time here, but let me ask you this, because in this context, I mean, the administration is making so many moves. Now, I understand on a political level, but from very early on, around the time of the inauguration, they were talking about a notion of a grand bargain where essentially money would be taken out of retirees and pensions and to basically pay off tax cuts that went to the wealthy under the Bush administration. President Obama has yet to fulfill that promise of allowing those tax rates to go back up to Clinton levels. And I'm talking to more and more, these are mainstream commentators who are talking about that we have essentially slipped into a plutocracy, that our government has been captured in many respects by big money.
Look, Sam, let me disagree with those voices only a little bit. We haven't slipped into it. We've rushed into it in a full embrace. There simply has not been any creative new thinking when it comes to many of the macroeconomic issues there. And that, I think, has been a real part of the problem. There has been a failure at the level of the plutocracy. I'm not weaving a conspiracy theory. I think it's just that there's been a unity of worldview that emanated from a lot of the investment bankers, a lot of the lawyers surrounding them, a lot of the sort of policy wonks in Washington who confused the well-being of finance with the well-being of our economy. And this may or may not be out of malevolence, it doesn't matter, but I think it is a confusion that explains a lot of the policies that we have continued to pursue. And oddly, the dissident voices, look at Paul Volcker. Mm-hmm. There's a guy who has been at the epicenter of power as a free thinker, and with his booming authority, both physically 6'7", and his wealth of experience, he said, "Wait a minute, guys, Dodd-Frank and this pre-Volcker rule, it was just a perpetuation of the status quo, and there's a reason that those capital flows weren't working so well."
And
we need more voices like that.
I agree with you. I don't think it's a conspiracy, and I don't even know if it's necessarily a confusion, except for some extremely wealthy actors mm-hmm. acting in their best interest with
right.
disregard for the implications.
Yep. And the reality that decision making has gotten more and more insular. And I think that is why when you look at Tim Geithner was president of the New York Fed at the very moment the system was created that led to the excess concentration, the excess leverage, the failure of the Fed to do anything meaningful, even though it was clear to many people there were storm clouds and hurricanes on the horizon. Tim embraced it, built it, adopted it, continued it. Was chosen to be head of the New York Fed by a committee that had Hank Greenberg and John Whitehead from AIG and Goldman on it. And again, forget attributing motive. This is the world that so many people came from, that the insularity of the world led to an inability to consider. There's Paul Krugman out there who's been screaming from the sidelines saying this isn't working. Joe Stiglitz,
right.
Robert Reich. There are a lot of really smart academics. Not sort of rabble-rousers who are out there just throwing bombs. I mean, intellectual bombs, that's easy. These are serious people. You have Nobel laureates who have been saying the economics of what you guys are doing is simply wrong.
And
they haven't listened.
And from a political standpoint, how do we break this cycle? I mean, we see more and more of essentially the impact of this money changing our political system, influencing our political system, and from Progressives United Citizens United decision down. I mean, how do we break this cycle from a political standpoint?
Tough to know. I mean, I think in 2008, many of us felt we had broken through. We had a transformational president who would speak from a different vantage point. Hasn't quite worked out as planned. So now what is the question? I'm beginning to think we need to just run slates of candidates who are going to be thoughtful, smart, and I'm not talking about ideological rigidity here. I'm talking about smart economics that will begin to rebuild what we need. And those who read my columns know I'm not doctrinaire. I've said we got to control entitlements. This isn't some heinous conservative thing. This is simple arithmetic. In the long run, there are ways to do it that are smart and progressive. So let's do that. Change the tax code in ways that are smart and progressive to induce investment and generate the equity that you and I believe in. Reich's book, Aftershock, and his sort of condensation of it in the New York Times Week in Review last Sunday, which showed you graphically the data about concentrations of wealth and income are staggering. We need to run candidates for Congress, for the Senate, for town council who are going to just be loyal to those values and be hard, smart, and hard-nosed. That's maybe what it comes down to.
I've got some issues with your entitlement suggestions.
I know you do, but that's why I threw that in there. Just make sure you're listening.
Oh no, I've read that. I was gonna. I definitely have some issues with the raising of Social Security and Medicare eligibility ages. The Medicare one in particular is.
Well, look, let me put that aside. Social Security, I think. Anyway, look, that's a separate conversation.
That's a separate conversation,
which has an impact over 20, 30 years when done the right way. Well, look, I'll give you one that I think we'd agree on, which is the income that should be Social Security eligible for taxation should rise above the $106,800 where it's capped right now. It should go up higher, or maybe you stop at 106, but then say, but if you earn over $1 million, it's taxed between $1 million and $2 million. You know, there's a lot of different ways.
Yes, we're capturing, I think, somewhere around 8 percentage points less than we normally do in terms of income because of the disparity. Well, so what happened to that transformational president? I mean, you know, that's really the question that has been boggling me for, yep. And I think many on the left, is what happened to that transformational president? How did a guy who was so quick to jump the establishment, as it were, in terms of in running into this race, so quickly embrace the establishment once he became into office?
That I don't know, and I think there we're going to have to wait 15, 20 years to sort of maybe read his memoirs, maybe get inside accounts from people, maybe understand him better as a person. Who knows? I mean, I'm not sure speculating about that is terribly helpful at this point. It's hard to do, and I'm not sure. I certainly don't have any wisdom to shed on it. I just wish at the very get-go there had been a different universe of advisors. I wish that, if a Krugman or Robert Reich had been in the inner circle there, pushing a different set of policies, I think we'd be in a very different place right now.
All right. Well, I hope to speak to you before that 15 or 20 years.
Yeah, I certainly hope so.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Elliot Spitzer. I appreciate you taking the time.
Sam, always great to chat with you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll go over the clown car debate last night. Oh, boy. That was not a fun debate to watch, really. But I'm your humble servant. I watched it. I tweeted it. And then I think I drank probably a bottle of vodka. I probably should have drank it during it, but I was afraid what I would do. All right, folks. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. All right, we are back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not going to spend too much time with the debate. I will say that next time I'll have Elliot Spitzer on, we'll have an argument about the entitlement. He wants to. He called for in one of his Slate pieces a couple of weeks ago, slowly raising the eligibility requirements or age for Medicare, which is and Social Security. The Medicare one. The Social Security one is, in my estimation, is basically a theft, a redistribution of wealth upwards. And like he said, if we were to remove the cap at $106,000 or even do a donut hole to $1 million, whatever it is, you'd have no problems with Social Security's solvency. In terms of Medicare, raising the age of eligibility on Medicare is horrible policy. It doesn't even do what it purports to do. In other words, it's not going to save you any money. You're taking the least risky people, 65-year-olds, 66-year-olds, out of a risk pool. These are the people who are generally the healthiest people in Medicare because they're the youngest. And then you are then transferring them and making them the riskiest part of private insurance pools. So you are raising the cost of health insurance in the private sector, and you are raising the cost of health insurance in the public sector in terms of Medicare. It's bad policy. It's just out and out bad policy. And frankly, it's stupid politics, too. But be that as it may, that's not what I wanted to talk to Spitzer about, and so we'll leave that for another day. But so let's go to the I'm debating here as to I'm debating here as to what is the issue, which horridness should I play from the debate first? I mean, let's start with the more substantive thing. The most interesting thing that came out of the debate last night, aside from the fact that Michelle Bachmann really was bringing her like D game to this. I really thought that I think she was under the weather or something. Or based upon the amount of times that she said Obamacare in her first three answers, I think that she is geared up looking to run against, run for Mitt Romney's vice presidential nominee. Because Romney, of course, has a little bit of trouble dealing with Obamacare because of Romney care. But be that as it may, the most interesting exchange came about, and this, of course, was Rick Perry's first time on the debate stage with his fellow clown car members. And Rick Perry really struck me. I've never really seen him in any type of setting other than I think that clip that we played of him talking about abstinence. And I thought, wow, okay, that guy's really dumb. But, boy, he really brought his stupidity last night. And here he is. And I think the Romney people might be right about this. The Romney people are saying this is why he can never win the general election. And this is an exchange that Perry had regarding Social Security. So this is clip number one.
Governor Perry, you said you wrote the book Fed Up to start a conversation. Congratulations. It's certainly done that in recent weeks. In the book, you call Social Security the best example of a program that, quote, violently tossed aside any respect for states' rights. We understand your position that it's got funding problems now. I'd like you to explain your view that Social Security was wrong right from the beginning.
Well, I think any of us that want to go back and change 70 years of what's been going on in this country is probably going to have a difficult time. And rather than spending a lot of time talking about what those folks were doing back in the 30s and the 40s is a nice intellectual conversation. But the fact is, we got to be focused on how we're going to change this program. And people who are on Social Security today, men and women who are receiving those benefits today, are individuals of my age that are on in line pretty quick to get them. They don't need to worry about anything. But I think the Republican candidates are talking about ways to transition this program. And it is a monstrous lie. It is a Ponzi scheme to tell our kids that are 25 or 30 years old today, you're paying into a program that's going to be there. Anybody that's for the status quo with Social Security today is involved with a monstrous lie to our kids, and it's not right.
So there's Rick Perry. and we apologize for the static that you're having. Hopefully on the podcast we won't have any of that. We'll have some clean audio. So here's Rick Perry challenging, and this is a difficult situation for him here. He is trying to pivot and say that Social Security is not going to work, but he has in the past challenged Social Security as fundamentally as something that shouldn't exist. And George Bush learned the hard way that you can't really get away with that. And so Romney is now going to follow up and try and box Perry into that corner by forcing Perry to say that Social Security is illegitimate. Now, understand here, this is a talking point on the right. Perry is trying to say that he is more conservative than Romney, and Romney is trying to say that he's more electable and trying to push Rick Perry into the zone of you're completely back crap crazy, which is that Social Security shouldn't exist. So here is Romney coming back with that.
Well, the issue is not the funding of Social Security. We all agree and have for years that the funding program of Social Security is not working. And Congress has been raiding the dollars from Social Security to pay for annual government expenditures. That's wrong. The funding, however, is not the issue. The issue in the book Fed Up,
Governor, this is where Romney says we should put it in a lockbox. We should put the funding in a lockbox and not allow Congress to raid it. Now, of course, we all agree that Social Security Trust Fund has been raided. The question is, do we have an obligation to pay it back? Why was it raided? To pay for the Bush tax cuts on the wealthy. Why don't they want to pay it back? Well, because then they'll have to make it up with income taxes. This is the crux of the matter. But Romney's not going to call for a lockbox.
Annual government expenditures. That's wrong. The funding, however, is not the issue. The issue in the book Fed Up, Governor, is you say that by any measure, Social Security is a failure. You can't say that to tens of millions of Americans who live on Social Security and those who have lived on it. The governor says, look, states ought to be able to opt out of Social Security. Our nominee has to be someone who isn't committed to abolishing Social Security, but who's committed to saving Social Security. We have always had at the heart of our party a recognition that we want to care for those in need, and our seniors have the need of Social Security. I will make sure that we keep the program and we make it financially secure, we save Social Security. And under no circumstances would I ever say, by any measure, it's a failure. It is working for millions of Americans, and I'll keep it working for millions of Americans. And we've got to do that as a party.
Thank you, Governor. Governor Perry, a 30-second rebuttal. Governor Romney said Vice President Cheney's right, and you're wrong about Ponzi scheme.
Well, here's, again, we're not trying to pick fights here.
Understood.
We're about fixing things. You can either have reasons or you can have results. And the American people expect us to put results in place. You cannot keep the status quo in place and not call it anything other than a Ponzi scheme. It is. That is what it is. Americans know that. And regardless of what anyone says, oh, it's not, and that's provocative language, maybe it's time to have some provocative language in this country and say things like, let's get America working again and do whatever it takes to make that happen.
Wow, that's provocative. He's really going out on a limb there. Let's get what it takes to have America working again and do what it takes. This guy, wow. And he's got a real problem here because Social Security has been, the system has stayed the same essentially over the past 70, almost 80 years now. And so he is calling this 80-year system, which in the worst-case scenario will pay out 78% of promised benefits starting in 3037 until we're all dead. All of us listening to this program are all dead. He's saying that's a Ponzi scheme. Well, a Ponzi scheme is that you run out of people who are putting money into the system. This is a generational transfer, and the younger generation gives to the older generation. That's the way Social Security works. If it was a Ponzi scheme, you would have to have all the young people die and not exist. They just go away. But there will always be young people. If not, then I think Social Security would be the least of our worries. We'll be in some type of like weird, Star Trek episode. There's no young people.
What's that movie, Children of Men?
There's no young people. There's no young people. They went away. That's when you hear like the figure $70 trillion. When you hear the figure $70 trillion. The country, it has a $70 trillion liability. That is somebody saying, we've got to pay out Social Security and we've got to pay out Medicare without any contemplation that there'll be young people alive to pay into the system. It's as if everybody gets to be 65. You come out of the womb and you're 65. So it is, in fact, not a Ponzi scheme. And, you know, I think if you want to really make sure that there is no Republican president in 2012, what you hope for is Romney to keep going after Perry this way, Perry entrenching himself more and exposing Romney as some type of liberal Northeast Republican rhino so that the crazies in the Republican Party nominate Perry. And do you want a reminder as to why you don't want a Republican president? You want a reminder of just how batshit crazy Republicans are? They gave it to you last night. And longtime listeners of this program know that I am against the death penalty, not just because it's been proven to kill innocent people. Philosophically, I am against the death penalty. I do not think that the state should have the right to murder people, to kill people. I just don't think that that's what civilized societies do. I just don't think they do that. In Texas, apparently not so civilized. And where is this? Simi Valley? Is that where Reagan Library is?
Yeah.
Not so civilized either. Just listen. This is going to make you nauseous. If you didn't see the debate, this is going to make you nauseous. This was the loudest applause line of the entire evening. The loudest applause line.
Governor Perry, a question about Texas. Your state has executed 234 death row inmates, more than any other governor in modern times. Have you struggled to sleep at night with the idea that any
Pause
one of those...
We're going to start this in the beginning. How fucking insane is that? And I'm sorry to swear during the free segment of the show, but if you have children who heard that, I can assure you that my saying that word is far less obscene than a crowd of people cheering because this guy has the record number of executions. I mean, in what universe would people applaud because he's got the record number of executions? I mean, even if these people were all supporters of the notion that when someone kills a cop or when someone kills a kid or when someone does a heinous crime, people should be executed, in what universe do you applaud that wildly? The biggest applause line of the whole night, because this guy has killed more people than any other governor. I can't even contemplate what goes through the mind of those people in the audience to spontaneously erupt. I mean, if they didn't think it was rude, they would have been hooting and hollering. Yeah, man, this guy. Are you applauding? Like, there were so many murders. So many people got killed in Texas that we were able to kill 234 of the people who committed those things. Like, woohoo!
I almost picture Yosemite Sam shooting his guns in the air.
But it's just bizarre. It's just bizarre. How much death are you applauding there? Man, you know, that probably means that there were whole families that were killed by murderers. Yeah! All right, play it from the beginning just so you can hear the disgustingness, and then we'll let Rick Perry pretend like he's solemnly thinking about this issue because I've got the life and death held in the crucible of my palm. Oh, and incidentally, there is strong reason to believe that Rick Perry not only executed innocent people, but quashed multiple investigations into proving the innocence of those people that he executed. And we'll put a link up on the site to a full rundown of that. But that's why he's got to think about it.
He wanted to keep his gamer score high. He wanted the record number of kills.
Don't take me off the leaderboard. Here we go.
A question about Texas. Your state has executed 234 death row inmates, more than any other governor in modern times. Have you struggled to sleep at night with the idea that any one of those might have been innocent?
No, sir, I've never struggled with that at all. The state of Texas has a very thoughtful, a very clear process in place of which when someone commits the most heinous of crimes against our citizens, they get a fair hearing, they go through an appellate process, they go up to the Supreme Court of the United States if that's required.
There we go. Ladies and gentlemen, very possibly the next nominee for the Republican president. And, of course, you know, in this country, being number one is really, that's probably going to be an asset to him, sadly. But that's probably going to be an asset. All right, folks, we've run out of time. We've got to move to the better half of the program. I got a great, interesting poll we'll talk about in the better half. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. For live listeners, I think we're going to just shut down and try and get rid of the static in between this break here. Also, folks, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, it is your membership that represents about 99.9% of the revenue we get for this program. And it is your support that will keep this program going. In addition, you get an extra 50 minutes of the better half of the program. I save all the better stuff for the better people. And, of course, you can support the show by donating your account at donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. You can give us a good rating on iTunes. That helps people find the show. 5 stars.
We've been rising on the iTunes podcast listings.
Really?
Yes.
You are having an effect, people. You may not be able to defeat the plutocracy, but you can defeat the podocracy. Podcastocracy. And, of course, Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And buy your crap at Amazon through our Amazon link. Thank you so much to those who have donated to send me to the Take Back the American Dream Conference. All right, see you on the better half.